half gave me. I'm pretty sure I can do this with my eyes closed, I told Owen, which is more than I can say for you. Aren't you the guy who missed your shot last time? A target as big as, well, an elephant? Anya joined us in the Land Rover. When we went out to collar an elephant, we needed 2 researchers and 3 vehicles so that the herd could be managed while we did our work. The other 2 Land Rovers were being driven by rangers, one of whom had already been tracking to Boho's herd today. Collaring is an art, not a science. I don't like to collar during droughts or in the summer when the temperature's too high. Elephants overheat so quickly that you need to monitor their temperature when they go down. The idea is to get the vet about 20 meters from the elephant so that he can safely shoot the dart. Once that matriarch drops, panic ensues, which is why you ideally want experienced rangers around you who know how to push a herd, and you don't want novices like Thomas Metcalf who might do something stupid. When we reached Bashi's vehicle, I glanced around, pleased. The landscape was perfect for a darting, flat and wide, so that the elephant, if she ran, wouldn't hurt herself. Owen, I said, you ready? He nodded, loading the M99 into his dart gun. Anya, you take the rear and I'll take the head. Bashi, Elvis, we want to push the herd to the south, I said. Okay. On 3. Wait. Thomas put his hand on my arm. What do I do? Stay in the rover and try not to get yourself killed. After that, I forgot about Thomas Metcalf. Owen shot the dart, which landed square into Boho's bottom. She startled and squealed, whipping her head around. She didn't pull out the little flag, and neither did another elephant, although sometimes I'd seen that happen. Her distress was contagious, though. The herd bunched, some facing backward around her for protection, some trying to touch her. There was rumbling that rattled the ground, and every elephant began to secrete the oily residue streaking their cheeks. Taboho walked a few steps, nodded, and then the M99 kicked in. Her trunk went limp, her head drooped, her body swayed, and she started to go down. That was when we had to act, and fast. If the herd wasn't moved away from the fallen matriarch, they could injure her trying to get her upright again, spearing her with a tusk, or make it impossible for us to get close enough to Taboho to revive her with an antidote. She could have fallen on a branch. She could have fallen on her trunk. The trick was to never show fear. If the herd came after us now and we backed off, we'd lose everything, including this matriarch. Now, I yelled, and Bashi and Elvis revved their engines. They clapped, howled, and chased the herd with the vehicles, scattering the elephants so that we could pull closer to the matriarch. As soon as there was a good gap between us and the other elephants, Owen and Anya and I leaped out of our vehicle, leaving the rangers to manage the flustered herd. We only had about 10 minutes. Immediately, I made sure Taboho was fully on her side and that the ground beneath her was clear. I folded her ear over her eye to protect her from dirt and direct sunlight. She stared at me, and I could see the terror in her gaze. Shh, I soothed. I wanted to stroke her, but knew I couldn't. Taboho was not asleep. She was conscious of every noise and touch and smell. For this reason, I would touch her as minimally as possible. I put a small stick between the 2 fingers of her trunk so that it would remain open. An elephant can't breathe through its mouth and will suffocate if the opening of the trunk is blocked. Taboho snored lightly as I poured water on her ear and over her body, cooling her down for comfort. Then I slipped the collar around her thick neck, settling the receiver of the unit on the top of the elephant and tied it down under her chin. I tightened the ratchet of the bolt, leaving a space of 2 hands between her chin and the counterweight, and filed down the metal edges. Anya worked madly, taking blood and a tiny skin clipping from Taboho's ear and plucking tail hair for DNA, measuring her feet and her temperature, her tusks, and the height from foot to scapula. Owen did a once-over, cataloging the elephant for injury, checking her breathing. Finally, we inspected the collar to make sure the GPS system was working, beeping properly. The whole thing had taken 9 minutes, 34 seconds. "We're good," I said, and Anya and I collected all the equipment we'd brought out to the elephant and carried it back to the vehicle. Bashi and Elvis both drove off as Owen leaned down beside Taboho once more. "Here, pretty girl," he cooed, and he injected the antidote into her ear, right into the bloodstream. We wouldn't leave until we knew the elephant was up. 3 minutes later, Taboho rolled to her feet, shaking her massive head, trumpeting at her herd. The collar seemed to fit all right as she meandered closer, rejoining them in a flurry of rumbles and bellows, touching and urinating. I was hot, sweaty, a mess. I had dirt on my face and elephant drool on my shirt, and I had completely forgotten Thomas Metcalf was still there until I heard his voice. "Owen," he said, "what's in the dart? M99?
"That's right," the vet replied. "I've read that a pinprick is enough to kill a human."
"True."
"So the elephant you just darted, she wasn't asleep. She was only paralyzed?"
The vet nodded.
"Briefly, but as you can see, no harm done." "Back at the sanctuary," Thomas said, "we have an Asian elephant named Wanda. She was at the zoo in Gainesville in 1981 when there were floods in Texas. Most of the animals were lost, but after 24 hours, someone saw her trunk sticking up in a flooded area. She was submerged for 2 days pretty much before the water receded enough for her to be rescued. Afterwards, she was terrified of thunderstorms. She wouldn't let any keepers give her a bath. She wouldn't step in a puddle. And this went on for years." "I don't know that I'd equate a 10-minute darting with 48 hours of trauma," Owen said, bristling. Thomas shrugged. "Then again," he pointed out, "you're not an elephant." As Anya bounced the Land Rover back to camp, I sneaked glances at Thomas Metcalf. It was almost as if he were implying that elephants had the capacity to think, to feel, to hold a grudge, to forgive. All of which came dangerously close to my beliefs, the same beliefs that I was ridiculed for here. I listened to him telling Owen about the New England Elephant Sanctuary as we traveled the 20 minutes back to the main camp. In spite of what I'd assumed, Metcalf was not a circus trainer or a zookeeper. He talked about his elephants like they were his family. He talked about them the way, well, the way I talked about mine. He ran a facility that took elephants once kept in captivity and let them live out the rest of their years in peace. He had come here to see if there was any way of making that experience more like their lives in the wild, short of bringing them back to Africa and Asia. I'd never met anyone like him. When we arrived at camp, Owen and Anya walked toward the research facility to log Taboho's data. Thomas stood, his hands in his pockets. "Listen, you're off the hook," he said.
"Excuse me?"
"I get it. You don't want to be saddled with me. You don't want to have to do the dog and pony show for some visitor. You've made that patently clear."
My rudeness had caught up to me, and now my cheeks burned. "I'm sorry," I said. "You're not who I thought you were." Thomas stared at me for a long moment, long enough to change the direction of the wind for the rest of my life. Then slowly, he grinned.
You were expecting George?
What happened to her? I later asked Thomas, as we drove out into the reserve by ourselves in a Land Rover. Wanda.
It took 2 years, and I spent a lot of time getting my clothes soaked, but now she swims in the sanctuary pond all the time.
When he said that, I knew where I was going to take him. I put the rover into low gear, surfing through the deep sand of a dry riverbed until I found what I was looking for. Elephant tracks look like Venn diagrams, the print of the front foot overlapping the back. These were fresh, flat, shiny circles that hadn't had time to be covered with dust. I could probably figure out the individual whose track I was seeing if I really wanted to, by paying attention to the crack marks of the imprint. Multiplying the back foot's circumference by 5.5 would give me her height, and I knew it was a female, because this was a breeding herd. There were multiple tracks instead of the solitary line of a bull. It was not all that far from Mabo's body. I wondered if this herd had come across her, what they had done. Pushing the thought out of my head, I put the truck in gear and followed the trail. I've never met anyone who ran an elephant sanctuary.
And I've never met anyone who's ever collared an elephant. I guess we're even.
What made you want to start a sanctuary?
In 1903, there was an elephant at Coney Island named Topsy. She helped build the theme park and gave rides and performed in shows. One day, her handler threw his lit cigarette in her mouth. She killed him, big surprise, and was labeled a dangerous elephant. Topsy's owners wanted her killed, so they turned to Thomas Edison, who was trying to show the dangers of AC current. He rigged up the elephant, and she died within seconds.
He looked at me.
1,500 people watched, including my great-grandfather.
So the sanctuary is some kind of legacy?
No, I didn't really remember the story until I was in college and worked one summer at a zoo. They had just gotten an elephant, Lucille. This was big news because elephants are always a draw. They were hoping she would pull the revenue of the zoo back into the black. I was hired as an assistant to the head keeper, who had extensive experience with circus elephants.
He glanced out at the bush.
Did you know you don't even have to touch an elephant with a bull hook to get it to do what you want? You just put it near the ear, and they'll move away from the threat of the pain because they know what to expect. Needless to say, I made the grave mistake of saying that elephants were conscious of how badly we were treating them. I was fired.
I just changed the focus of my field work to how elephants grieve. He glanced at me.
They're better at it than people.
I put my foot on the brake, so we rolled to a stop. My colleagues would argue with you. No, actually, they'd laugh at you. Like they laugh at me.
Why?
For their work, they can use collars and measurements and experimental data. What looks like cognition to one scientist looks like conditioning to another. And there's no conscious thought necessary for that. I turned to him. But let's say I could prove it. Can you imagine the implications for wildlife management? Like you said to Owen, is it ethical to dart an elephant with M99 if she's fully aware of what we're doing? Especially if it's a precursor to a shot in the head, like when we cull a herd? And if we shouldn't be doing that, how do we manage elephant populations? He glanced at me, fascinated.
That collar you put on the elephant, does it measure hormones, stress levels? Is she sick? How do you predict a death, so you know which elephant to collar?
Oh, we can't predict death. That collar's for someone else's project. They're trying to find out the turning radius of an elephant.
Whatever the elephant needs it to be, Thomas said with a laugh. That's the punchline, right?
I'm not kidding.
Really? How could anyone possibly think that research matters more than what you're doing?
He shook his head.
Wanda, the elephant that nearly drowned?
She has a partially paralyzed trunk, and she needed a security blanket of sorts when she came to the sanctuary. She got into the habit of dragging a tire around with her. Eventually, she bonded with Lily and didn't need the tire all the time anymore because she had a friend. But when Lily died, Wanda was pretty devastated. After Lily was buried, Wanda brought her tire to the gravesite and laid it down on top of the dirt. It was almost like she was paying tribute. Or maybe she thought Lily needed a little comfort now.
I had never heard anything so moving in my life. I wanted to ask him if sanctuary elephants stayed with the bodies of those they'd considered family. I wanted to ask if Wanda's behavior was the anomaly or the norm. Can I show you something? Making a decision on the spot, I took a detour, driving in a widening circle until we reached Mabo's body. I knew that Grant would have a fit if he learned I had taken a visitor to see an elephant corpse. One of the reasons we told the rangers of deaths was so that they could avoid taking tourists near a decaying body. By now, scavengers had picked apart the elephant. Flies buzzed in a cloud around the carcass. And yet, Onalena and three other elephants were standing quietly nearby. This was Mabo, I said. She was the matriarch of a herd of about 20 elephants. She died yesterday.
Who's in the distance?
Her daughter and some of the rest of the herd. They're mourning, I said defensively, even if I'm never able to prove it.
You could measure it, Thomas said, mulling. There are researchers who've worked with baboons in Botswana to measure stress. I'm pretty sure that fecal samples showed an increase in glucocorticoid stress markers after one of the baboons in the group was killed by a predator. And those markers were more pronounced in baboons that were socially linked to the dead one. So if you can get fecal matter from elephants, which looks to be pretty abundant, and can statistically show a rise in cortisol,
then maybe it works like it does in humans, to trigger oxytocin, I finished, which would be a biological reason for elephants to seek out comfort from each other after the death of a member of the herd, a scientific explanation for grief. I stared at him, amazed. I don't think I've ever met anyone quite as passionate as I am about elephants.
First time for everything, Thomas murmured.
You don't just run a sanctuary. He ducked his head.
My undergraduate degree was in neurobiology.
Mine too, I said. We both stared at each other, further adjusting our expectations. I noticed that Thomas had green eyes and that there was a ring of orange around each of his irises. When he grinned, I felt as if I'd taken a dart of M99, as if I was caught in the prison of my own body. We were interrupted by the sounds of rumbling. Ah, I said, forcing myself to turn away. Like clockwork.
What is?
You'll see. I put the Land Rover into low gear and started up a steep incline. When you approach wild elephants, I explained quietly, you do it the way you'd want your own worst enemy to approach you. Would you feel comfortable if he came in and surprised you from behind, or cut between you and your child? I pulled the vehicle in a wide circle at the plateau, and then crested the edge downhill to reveal a breeding herd splashing in a pond. Three calves piled on top of each other in a mud puddle, the one on the bottom rolling out from underneath his cousins and spraying a fountain in the air. But even their mothers were wading and kicking, making waves, wallowing. "That's the matriarch," I told him, pointing to Boipelo. "And that's Akanyang, with the folded ear. She's Dineo's mother. Dineo's the cheeky one, tripping his brother over there." I introduced Thomas to each elephant by name, ending with Kahiso. "She's due to deliver in about a month," I told him. "Her first calf."
"Our girls play in the water all the time," Thomas said, delighted. "I figured they picked that behavior up at the zoos where they used to live as distraction. I assumed that in the bush, it's always life or death."
"Well, yeah," I agreed. "But play is part of life. I've seen a matriarch slide down a steep bank on her butt just for fun." I leaned back, propping my sneakers on the dashboard, letting Thomas watch the antics. One calf threw herself sideways in the mud, displacing her younger sibling, who squealed his distress. Just like that, their mother trumpeted, "Enough, you two!"
"This is exactly what I came here to see," Thomas said softly.
I looked at him. "A watering hole?" He shook his head.
"When an elephant is brought to us at the sanctuary, she's already broken. We do our best to put her back together again, but it's all guesswork, unless you know what she looked like when she was whole."
Thomas faced me.
"You're lucky to see this every day."
I didn't tell him that I'd also seen calves orphaned by culling and droughts so severe that the skin of the elephants stretched over their hip bones like canvas on a frame. I didn't tell him how, in the dry season, herds would split up so that they didn't have to compete with each other for limited resources. I didn't tell him about Kenosi's brutal death.
"I told you my life story," Thomas said, "but you haven't told me what brought you to Botswana."
"They say people who work with animals do it because they're no good around other people."
"Having met you," he said dryly, "I'll refrain from commenting."
The elephants were nearly all out of the water by now, trudging up the steep slope to dust their backs with dirt and amble into the distance wherever the matriarch led. The last female pushed her baby's rump, giving him a boost uphill before scrambling up herself. They moved away in a silent, syncopated rhythm. I've always thought elephants walk as if they have music being piped into their heads that no one else can hear. And from the roll of their hips and their swagger, I'm going to guess that the artist is Barry White. I work with elephants because it's like watching people at a cafe, I told Thomas. They're funny, heartbreaking, inventive, intelligent. God, I could go on and on. There's just so much of us in them. You can watch a herd and see babies testing limits, moms taking care, teenage girls coming out of their shells, teenage boys blustering. I can't watch lions all day, but I could watch this my whole life.
I think I could, too, Thomas said.
But when I faced him, he was not looking at the elephants. He was staring at me. It was the habit of the camp not to let our guests walk unescorted through the main camp. At dinner time, rangers or researchers would meet guests at their huts and lead them by flashlight to the dining hall. This wasn't meant to be charming. It was practical. I'd seen more than one tourist run in a panic after a warthog crossed the path unannounced. When I went to get Thomas for dinner, his door was ajar. I knocked and then pushed it open. I could smell the soap from his shower hanging in the air. The fan was turning over the bed, but it was still beastly hot. Thomas sat at the desk in his khakis and a white tank, his hair damp, his jaw freshly shaved. His hands were moving with quick efficiency over what looked like a tiny square of paper.
"Just a second,"
he said, not looking up. I waited, jamming my thumbs into my belt loops. I rocked back and forth on the heels of my boots.
"Here," Thomas said, turning around. "I made this for you."
He reached for my hand and pressed into my palm a tiny origami elephant, crafted out of a U.S. dollar bill. In the days that followed, I started to see my adopted home through Thomas's eyes, the quartz glittering in the soil like a handful of diamonds that had been tossed outside, the symphony of birds grouped by voice part on the branches of a mapani tree being conducted by a distant vervet monkey, ostriches running like old ladies in high heels, their plumes bobbing. We talked about everything from poaching in the Thule Circle to the residual memories of elephants and how they tied into PTSD. I played him tapes of Must songs and Estrus songs, and we wondered if there could be other songs passed down in low frequencies we could not hear to teach elephants the history they mysteriously accumulated. Which areas were dangerous and which were safe? Where to find water, what the most direct route was from one home range to another. He described how an elephant might be transported to the sanctuary from a circus or a zoo after being labeled dangerous, how tuberculosis was a growing problem in captive elephants. He told me about Olive, who had performed on television and at theme parks, who one day broke loose from her chains, and how a zoologist was killed trying to catch her. Of Lily, whose leg was broken in a circus and never reset. They had an African elephant, too, Hester, who was orphaned as a result of culling in Zimbabwe, and who had performed in a circus for almost 20 years before her trainer decided to retire her. Thomas was in negotiations now to bring in another African elephant, named Mora, who he hoped would be a companion for Hester. In return, I told him that while wild elephants will kill with their front feet, kneeling to crush their victims, they use their sensitive back feet to stroke the body of a fallen elephant, how the pads of those feet will hover over the skin and circle, as if they are sensing something we can only guess at. I told him how I once brought the jawbone of a bull back to camp to study, and how that night, Kefense, a subadult male, broke into camp, took the bone from my porch, and returned it to the place of his friend's death. I told him how, the first year I came to the reserve, a Japanese tourist who had wandered away from camp was killed by a charging elephant. When we went to retrieve the body, we found the elephant covering the man, standing vigil. On the evening before Thomas was supposed to fly home, I took him somewhere I'd never taken anyone before. At the top of the hill was a huge baobab tree. The native people believed that when the Creator called the animals together to help plant all the trees, the hyena was late. He was given the baobab, and he was so angry he planted it upside down, giving it a topsy-turvy look, as if its roots were scratching the sky instead of buried beneath the ground. Elephants liked to eat the bark of the baobab and used it for shade. The old bones of an elephant named Matusi were scattered in its vicinity. I watched Thomas go still as he realized what he was seeing. The bones glowed in the boil of the sun.
"Are these?"
"Yes." I parked the rover and got out, encouraging him to do the same. This area was safe at this time of day. Thomas moved carefully through Matusi's remains, picking up the long curve of a rib, touching his fingertips to the honeycomb center of a split hip joint. Matusi died in 1998, I told him, but his herd still visits. They get quiet and reflective, kind of like we would if we went to visit someone's grave. I leaned down, picking up two vertebrae and notching them together. Some of the bones had been carried off by scavengers, and we had Matusi's skull at the camp. The remaining bones were so white that they looked like rips in the weave of the earth. Without really thinking about what we were doing, we started gathering them until they formed a collection at our feet. I pulled up a long femur, grunting as I dragged it. We moved in silence, creating a puzzle that was larger than life. When it was done, Thomas took a stick and drew an outline around the elephant's skeleton. "There," he said, stepping back. "We just did in an hour what it took nature 40 million years to do." There was a peace wrapped around us, like cotton batting. The sun was setting, simmering through a cloud.
"You could come back with me, you know," Thomas said. "At the sanctuary, you'd be able to observe plenty of grief. And your family in the States must miss you."
My chest tightened. "I can't."
"Why?"
"I saw a calf get shot in front of its mother. And not a little calf, either. A nearly grown one. She wouldn't leave him. Not for days. When I saw that, something just changed in me." I glanced at Thomas. "There is no biological advantage to grief. In fact, in the wild, it can be downright dangerous to be moping around or swearing off food. I couldn't look at that matriarch and say I was watching a conditioned behavior. That was sorrow, pure and simple."
"You're still grieving for that calf," Thomas said.
"I guess I am."
"Is his mother?"
I didn't reply. I had seen Laredo in the months since Kenosi's death. She was busy with her younger calves. She had gone back to being a matriarch. She had moved past that moment in a way that I hadn't been able to.
"My father died last year," Thomas said. "I still look for him in crowds."
"I'm sorry." He shrugged.
"I think grief is like a really ugly couch. It never goes away. You can decorate around it. You can slap a doily on top of it. You can push it to the corner of the room. But eventually, you learn to live with it."
Somehow, I thought, elephants had taken it a step further. They didn't grimace every time they entered the room and saw that couch. They said, "Remember how many good memories we had here?" And they sat for just a little while before moving elsewhere. Maybe I started crying. I can't remember. But Thomas was so close now that I could smell the soap on his skin. I could see the sparks of orange in his eyes.
"Alice, who have you lost?"
I froze. This wasn't about me. I wouldn't let him make it that way.
"Is that why you push people away?" he whispered. "So they can't get close enough to hurt you when they're gone?"
This virtual stranger knew me better than anyone else in Africa. He knew me better than I knew myself. What I was really researching was not how elephants deal with loss, but how humans can't. And because I did not want to let go, because I didn't know how, I wrapped my arms around Thomas Metcalf. I kissed him in the shade of the baobab tree, with its upside-down roots in the air, with its bark that could be cut 100 times and still heal itself.
Jenna. The walls of the institution where my father lives are painted purple. It makes me think of Barney, that giant creepy dinosaur. But apparently some very renowned psychologist wrote an entire PhD dissertation about which color inspires healing, and this was right at the top of the list. The nurse on duty looks straight at Serenity when we walk in, which I guess makes sense because we appear to be a family unit, if a dysfunctional one.
Can I help you?
I'm just here to see my dad, I say.
Thomas Metcalf,
Serenity adds. I know several of the nurses here. This one I haven't met, which is why she doesn't recognize me. She puts a clipboard on the counter so that I can sign us in, but before I do, I hear my father's voice, shouting somewhere down the hall.
Dad?
I call out. The nurse looks bored. Name, she says. Sign us in and meet me in room 124, I tell Serenity, and I start to run. I can feel Virgil falling into step beside me.
Serenity Jones,
I hear her say, and then I throw open the door to my dad's room. He is fighting against the grip of 2 burly orderlies.
For the love of God, let me go!
He yells, and then he spies me.
Alice, tell them who I am!
There's a broken radio that looks like it's been hurled across the room. Its wires and transistors draped across the floor like a robot autopsy. The trash can has been overturned, and there are crumpled paper pill cups and tangles of masking tape and the peel of an orange scattered around. In my father's hand is a box of breakfast cereal. He's holding on to it like it's a vital organ. Virgil stares at my dad. I can only imagine what he's seeing. A man with wild, snowy hair and pretty lousy personal grooming habits, who's skinny and fierce and completely off his rocker.
He thinks you're Alice?
Virgil says under his breath. Thomas, I soothe, stepping forward. I'm sure the gentleman will understand if you calm down.
How can I calm down when they're trying to steal my research?
By now, Serenity has come through the doorway, too, stopping dead at the struggle.
What's going on?
The orderly with a blonde buzz cut glances up.
He got a little agitated when we tried to throw out the empty cereal box.
If you stop fighting, Thomas, I'm sure they'll let you keep your research, I say. To my surprise, that's all it takes for my dad to go limp. Immediately, the orderlies release him, and he sinks back in the chair, clutching that stupid box to his chest.
I'm all right now,
he mutters.
Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs,
Virgil murmurs. Serenity shoots him a sharp glare.
Thank you so much,
she says pointedly to the orderlies, as they pick up the trash that's all over the floor.
No problem, ma'am,
one replies as the other pats my dad on the shoulder.
You take it easy, bro,
he says. My dad waits until they leave and then stands and grabs my arm.
Alice, you cannot imagine what I've just discovered.
His eyes focus suddenly past me, on Virgil and Serenity.
Who are they?
Friends of mine, I say. That seems to be good enough.
Look at this.
He points to the box. There is a bright cartoon of something that might be a turtle and might be a cucumber with legs. Saying in a thought bubble, did you know
that crocodiles can't stick out their tongues?
That honeybees have hair on their eyes to help them collect pollen? Anjana, a chimp at a rescue facility in South Carolina, has raised white tiger cubs, leopard and lion cubs, bottle feeding and playing with the babies? Kashik, an elephant, can accurately speak 6 Korean words?
Of course he's not speaking 6 words.
My father says.
He's imitating the keepers. I Googled the scientific paper this morning after that imbecile Louise finally got off the computer because she'd reached the next level of Candy Crush. What's fascinating is that he apparently learned to communicate for social reasons. He was kept apart from other elephants, and the only interaction he had socially was with human caregivers. You know what this means?
I glance at Serenity and shrug. No. What?
Well, if there's documented proof that an elephant learned to imitate human speech, can you imagine the implications for how we think about elephants' theory of mind?
Speaking of theories, Virgil says.
What's your field of study?
My father asks him. Virgil does retrieval work. I improvise. Serenity's interested in communication. He brightens.
Through what medium?
Yes, Serenity says. My father looks baffled for a moment, but then forges on.
Theory of mind covers two critical ideas, that you have an awareness of being a unique being, with your own thoughts and feelings and intentions, and that this is true for other beings, and that they don't know what you're thinking, or vice versa, until these things are communicated. The evolutionary benefit, of course, of being able to predict the behavior of others based on that is enormous. For example, you can pretend to be injured, and if someone doesn't know you're faking, they will bring you food and take care of you, and you don't have to do any work. Humans aren't born with this ability. We develop it. Now, we know that for theory of mind to exist, humans have to use mirror neurons in the brain. And we know that mirror neurons fire when the task involves understanding others through imitation and when acquiring language. If Kashyyyk the elephant is doing that, doesn't it also stand to reason that the other things mirror neurons signify in humans, like empathy, are also present in elephants?
When I hear him talk, I realize how incredibly smart he must have been before. I realize what made my mother fall in love with him. That reminds me why we're here. My father turns to me.
We need to get in touch with the authors of the paper.
He muses.
Alice, can you imagine the implications for my research?
He reaches for me. I feel Virgil tense up and hugs me, swinging me in a circle. I know he thinks I'm my mother, and I know it's totally creepy. But you know, sometimes it's just nice to be hugged by my dad. Even if the reasons are all wrong. He puts me down, and I have to admit, I haven't seen him look this fired up in a while.
Dr. Metcalf,
Virgil says,
I know this is really important to you, but I wonder if you might have time to answer a few questions about the night your wife disappeared.
My father's jaw tightens.
What are you talking about? She's right here.
That's not Alice,
Virgil replies.
That's your daughter, Jenna.
He shakes his head.
My daughter is a child. Look, I don't know what you're playing at, but...
Stop agitating him,
Serenity interjects.
You're not going to get anything out of him if he's upset.
Out of me?
My father's voice rises.
You're here to steal my research, too?
He advances on Virgil, but Virgil grabs my hand and pulls me between them so that my father cannot help but see me.
Look at her face.
He urges.
Look at her.
It takes 5 seconds for my dad to respond. And let me tell you, 5 seconds is a really long time. I stand there watching his nostrils flare with every breath, and his Adam's apple climb up and down the ladder of his throat.
Jenna?
My father whispers. For just a fraction of a second when he looks at me, I know that he's not seeing my mother. That I'm... What did he say? A unique being with my own thoughts and feelings and intentions. That I exist. And then he's crushing me against him again. But this is different. Protective and amazed and tender. As if he could shield me from the rest of the world, which is ironically all I've ever done for him. His hands span my back like wings.
Dr. Metcalf,
Virgil says.
About your wife.
My father holds me at arm's length and glances in the direction of Virgil's voice. That's all it takes to break whatever glass thread has been spun between us. When he turns to me again, I know he's not seeing me at all. In fact, he's not even looking at my face. His gaze is fixated on the tiny pebble hanging from a chain around my neck. Slowly, he lifts the pendant with his fingers. He turns it over so that the mica glitters. "My wife," he repeats. His fist tightens on the chain, snapping it off my neck. The necklace falls to the floor between us as my father slaps me so hard that I go flying across the room.
"You fucking bitch," he says.
Alice. I have a story that is not one of my own, but was told to me by Owen, the bush vet. A few years ago, researchers were darting in a communal area. They had targeted one specific female and shot the M99 dart from a vehicle. She dropped, as expected, but the herd bunched very tightly around the female, preventing the other rangers from driving them away. They couldn't get to her to put on the collar, so they waited a bit to see what would happen. Two concentric circles formed around the fallen female. The outer circle stood with their backsides to her, facing out at the vehicles, impassive. But there was an inner circle behind them that the researchers could not quite see, blocked as they were by the bulky bodies on the front line. They could hear rustling and movement and the snapping of branches. Suddenly, as if on cue, the herd stepped away. The elephant that had been darted lay on her side, covered with broken branches and a huge pile of soil. After birth, a calf is dusted by its mother to cover the smell of blood, which is a huge attraction for predators. But there was no blood on this female elephant. I've heard, too, that the reason elephants might cover a corpse is to mask the death smell. But again, I don't believe it. Elephant noses are so incredibly sensitive, there is no way they would have mistaken an elephant that had been darted for one that was no longer alive. I have, of course, seen elephants dust and cover dead companions or calves that did not survive. It often seems to be a behavior reserved for deaths that are unexpected or somehow aggressive, and the deceased does not necessarily have to be an elephant. A researcher who came to the reserve via Thailand told a story of an Asian bull that was part of an elephant-backed safari company. He had killed the mahout who had trained him and cared for him for 15 years. Now the bull was in must, which in Hindi means madness. In must, brain power takes a back seat to hormones. Yet after the attack, the bull got very still and backed away, as if he knew he had done something wrong. Even more interesting were the female elephants, which covered the mahout with dirt and branches. The week before I left Botswana forever, I had been putting in long hours. I observed Kahiso with her dead calf. I was writing up notes from the death of Mabo. One hot day, I got out of the jeep to stretch my legs, and I lay down beneath the baobab tree where I had last been with Thomas. I am not a light sleeper. I do not do stupid things, like get out of the Land Rover in spots that are heavily trafficked by elephants. I do not even remember closing my eyes. But when I awakened, my pad and pencil were somewhere on the ground, and my mouth and eyes were gritty with dirt. There were leaves in my hair and branches piled on top of me. The elephants that had covered me were nowhere to be found when I awakened, which was probably a good thing. I could just as easily have been killed as partially buried alive. I had no explanation for my deep, comatose nap, for my lapse of judgment, except that I was not myself. I was more than myself. I've always found it ironic that the elephants which found me sleeping assumed I was dead, when in reality, I was full of life.
approximately 10 weeks along, to be exact.
Serenity. Once, on my TV show, I had on a doctor who talked about hysterical strength, the life-and-death moments when people do extraordinary things, like lifting a car off a loved one. The common denominator was a high-stress situation that triggered adrenaline, which in turn led to someone transcending the limits of what his or her muscles should be capable of doing. I had 7 guests that day. Angela Cavallo, who had lifted a 1964 Chevy Impala off her son Tony, Lydia Angiou, who had wrestled a polar bear in Quebec when it was coming after her 7-year-old son during a game of pond hockey, and Didi and Dominique Prue, 12-year-old twins who had pushed a tractor off their grandfather when it toppled over on a steep slope.
"It was like crazy," Didi told me. "We went back and tried to move the tractor after. We couldn't budge it an inch."
It's what I'm thinking about when Thomas Metcalf smacks Jenna across the face. One minute, I'm watching like a spectator, and the next, I'm shoving him away and diving against all principles of space and gravity so that Jenna lands in my arms. She looks up at me, as surprised as I am to find herself in my embrace.
"I've got you,"
I tell her fiercely, and I realize I mean it, in every interpretation. I am not a mother, but maybe that's what I'm supposed to be right now for this girl. Virgil, for his part, smacks Thomas so hard that he falls back into the chair. A nurse and one of the orderlies burst into the room, having heard the crash. "Grab him," the nurse says, and Virgil moves aside as the orderly restrains Thomas. She glances at us on the floor. "Are you all right?" "Fine," I say, as Jenna and I stand. The truth is, I'm not all right, and neither is she. She's gingerly touching the spot where she was slapped, and me, I feel like I'm going to throw up. Have you ever felt like the air was too heavy, or gotten an inexplicable chill? That's somatic intuition. I used to be a pretty good empath. I could walk into a room as if I were dipping my toe into bathwater to test it for energy and know if it was good or bad, if a murder had gone down there, or if there was sadness coating the walls like layers of paint. For whatever it's worth, there's some weird shit swirling around Thomas Metcalf. Jenna is trying hard to hold it together, but I can see the sheen of tears in her eyes. From across the room, Virgil pushes off the wall, clearly agitated. His jaw is so tight, I can tell he's fighting to not unleash a stream of curses at Thomas Metcalf. He blows out of the room, a tornado. I look at Jenna. She stares at her father as if she has never seen him before. And maybe that's true, in a way. "What do you want to do?" I murmur. The nurse glances at us.
"I think we'll sedate him for a while. Might be best if you come back later."
I wasn't asking her, but that's all right. Maybe it even makes it easier for Jenna to leave her father, who still hasn't apologized. I slip my arm through hers and pull her tight against me, tugging her out of the room. As soon as I cross the threshold, it's easier to breathe. There's no sign of Virgil in the hallway, or even in the front foyer. I lead Jenna past other patients, who stare at her as we pass. At least their caregivers have the grace to pretend they don't see her fighting back her sobs, her cheek red and swollen. Virgil paces in front of my car. He looks up when he sees us.
"We shouldn't have come here."
He grasps Jenna's chin and turns her face so that he can see the damage.
"You're gonna have a hell of a shiner."
"Great," she says, glum. "Should be fun explaining that to my grandma."
"Tell her the truth,"
I suggest. "Your dad's not stable. If he decked you, it wouldn't be out of character."
"I already knew that before we came," Virgil blurts out. "I knew Metcalf was violent."
Jenna and I face him.
What?
She asks.
My dad isn't violent.
Virgil just raises an eyebrow.
Was, he repeats. Some of the most psychopathic guys I've ever met are domestic abusers. They're charming as all get out when they're in public. In private, they're animals. There was some indication during the investigation that your dad was abusive to your mother. Another employee mentioned it. Clearly, your father thought you were Alice back there, which means
that my mom might have run away to protect herself,
Jenna says.
She might have had absolutely nothing to do with Nevi Rule's death.
Virgil's cell phone starts to ring. He answers it, hunching forward so that he can hear the call. He nods and walks a few feet away. Jenna looks up.
But that still doesn't explain where my mom went, or why she didn't try to come for me.
Out of the blue, I think, she's stuck. I still don't know if Alice Metcalf is dead, but she is certainly acting the way an earthbound spirit would, like a ghost who's afraid of being judged for her behavior while living. I'm saved from answering Jenna by the return of Virgil.
My parents were happily married,
Jenna tells him.
You don't call the love of your life a fucking bitch,
Virgil says frankly.
That was Tallulah at the lab. The mitochondrial DNA from your cheek swab was a match to the hair from the evidence bag. Your mother was the redhead in close proximity to Nevi Rule before she died.
To my surprise, Jenna seems annoyed by this information, rather than upset.
Look, could you make up your mind? Is it my mother who's the crazed killer, or is it my father? Because I'm getting whiplash bouncing back and forth between your theories.
Virgil looks at Jenna's injured eye.
Maybe Thomas went after Alice, and she ran into the enclosure to escape. Nevi was there doing whatever she was supposed to be doing that night for her job. She got in the way and was killed in the process by Thomas. Feeling guilty about a murder is a pretty good trigger to lose your grasp on reality and wind up in an institution.
Yeah, Jenna says sarcastically. And then he cued the elephant to come walk back and forth on top of Nevi so it would look like she was trampled, because, you know, they're trained to do that.
It was dark. The elephant could have stepped on the body accidentally.
20 or 30 times? I read the autopsy report, too. Plus, you don't have any evidence of my father being inside those enclosures.
Yet,
Virgil says. If Thomas Metcalf's room made me queasy, then being between these two makes me feel like my head is going to explode.
Too bad Nevi's gone, I say cheerfully. She'd be a great resource.
Jenna takes a step toward Virgil.
You know what I think?
Does it matter, because you and I both know you're going to tell me anyway?
I think that you're so busy accusing everyone else that night, so you don't have to admit that you're the one to blame for a crappy investigation.
And I think you're a spoiled little shit who isn't actually brave enough to open Pandora's box and see what's inside.
You know what? Jenna yells. You're fired!
You know what?
Virgil shouts back.
I quit.
Good.
Fine.
She turns on her heel and starts running.
What am I supposed to do? He asks me. I said I'd find her mom. I didn't say she'd like the results.
God, that kid drives me up a freaking wall.
I know.
Her mother probably stayed away because she's such a pain in the ass.
He grimaces.
I don't mean that. Jenna's right. If I'd trusted my instincts 10 years ago, we'd never be here.
The question is, would Alice Metcalf? We both think about that for a moment. Then he glances at me.
One of us should go after her. And by one of us, I mean you.
I take my keys out of my purse and unlock the car.
You know, I used to filter the information I got from spirits. If I thought it was going to be painful to my client or upsetting, I'd leave the message out of my reading, just pretend I never heard it.
But eventually I realized it wasn't my business to judge the information I was getting. It was just my job to relay it. Virgil squints.
I can't tell if you're agreeing with me.
I slide into the driver's seat, turn on the ignition, and roll down my window. I'm just saying that you don't have to be the ventriloquist. You're the dummy.
You just wanted to be able to say that to